Okay, we'll get started again. So, in the first half, we had a look at what we meant by a simulation model. We're looking at very specifically discrete event simulation models. Now, we're going to look at the basic components of how you would build a simulation model. And what we saw in the preceding example was that what we had was this future event list, where times were tracked by clocks, and sort of the actual system behavior was determined by sort of picking the next event off the future event list, so with the one that was due to occur in sort of the nearest future, and the occurrence of the event then potentially triggered other events. And typically, we needed to know a combination of the event and the event state, or sorry, the system state, in order to determine sort of what future events were triggered. Okay. So, what we're going to look at now is a couple of specific aspects. We're going to look at sort of managing this event list. And there are really two components. One is, again, the system logic that says what goes on and off the list. And there's not a whole pile that you can say sort of generically about that. It's very much tied up with how you're modeling your system. We are going to look at timing. So if you have something that's where the time is randomly distributed, how do we get that sort of a randomly distributed number? What does a randomly distributed number even mean? And also back to managing the event list, we're going to have a look at, again, just what lists are in computer programs anyway. Okay. So, again, we're dealing with discrete event systems where we assume that sort of the system stays in some way stable in between occurrences of events. Typically what you can say is if you know the events, the trace of events if you observe a trace of events, you should be able to recreate the you should be able to recreate the state of the system and have a sort of sequence of states as well. That may or may not work the other way depending on how you set up your system. Okay. But what we're concerned with is the events occurring and their time of occurrence. Okay. So we have a number of key components. We have events and clocks, and the combination of events and clocks, again, can be used to give us a next event list. Okay, so it can be used for us to determine which events are going to occur and in what order. Okay. So we also, again, need to know the state of the system in order to generate this next event list. So just we need to in some way be able to decide which events are going to occur next. And so what the simulator is going to do is it's going to examine events as they're taken off. You can think of the next event list maybe as being an ordered list, sort of ordered according to time of occurrence. So the simulator is going to examine the events as they come off the event list, as they're selected as the next event to occur. And this is going to change the state of the system. And the bit we're concerned about is it's going to change the event list. Okay? So if things are easy, all that happens is more events get added on. In some cases, you may actually take events off. You have a fire, the next event is the building burns down, unless the sprinkler system activates. So when the sprinkler system activates, the event of the building burning down has to be taken off. Okay. So again, that all has to be written into the logic of the system. Okay, just for completeness, I've been describing what is called an event advance model. The state of the simulation moves from one event occurrence to the next event occurrence to the next event occurrence. Okay. There are other possibilities. Unit time advance and activity-based advance. We'll define each of those again just for context more than anything else. If you guys are taking the broadband networks module from Martin Collier, he's going to make you write a unit time advance simulation so you can sort of compare and contrast how they differ. Okay, so again, an event advanced simulation. Everything sort of centers around the future event list, and we just move the system from event to event to event. And so the master clock gets updated to the time of occurrence of the next event. Okay. And when an event occurs, your future event list gets updated, the current event is removed, new events are scheduled if they are a consequence of the event that occurred, and you know, as I say, sometimes events are descheduled as well. Okay. Unit time advance, it uses the master clock to drive the system instead of the events. And so the master clock just keeps marching forward one time unit at a time. And then when the master clock sort of hits a time of occurrence of an event, then at that point sort of the system changes. Okay. And can be useful to just serve as an implementation technique if things are happening at fairly regular time units. Okay, finally we have activity-based simulation, and activities. It focuses on, instead of events, it assumes that the events are linked to things happening in a system. Okay. Yeah, so jobs being done in a system. And so, just philosophically, since what's of interest is the jobs themselves, we can represent them as sort of activities with duration and look at the sequences and the overlaps of those activities. instead of specifically at the events, at the events. Okay. And in this case, we assume that certain activities lead to other activities. So before we had events led to other events, now we have activities leading to other activities. And again, what we need to write down then is the starting point and the duration of those activities, and that is the representation of our behavior. Okay. And so if you thought about a queue, your activities, well, you have the process of arriving or of inter-arriving, so it takes jobs a certain while to arrive. There's the process of waiting in the queue, so that's something with duration. The process of arriving, again, leads to the process of waiting, which eventually leads to the process of getting service. Okay, so you have these sequences which sort of spawn each other, and you know, again, one process can lead to multiple, or one activity can lead to multiple follow-on activities, and so you can denote, again, overlaps, etc. Okay. And again, the main difference is just going to be how you implement this. We're not going to be too concerned with it. Just I mention it in case you again run across it in your reading. What we are dealing with is this first method of advanced simulation. Okay. So, the major components of the event-based simulation model are the events with their clocks and the system state. Okay. And what this leads us to is, again, the generation of this next event list, our future event list. Okay. And so the core of our simulation is going to be how we handle this future event list. And in order to do this, well, again, we're going to have to timestamp our events. We're going to have to, in some way, determine the time of occurrence of events, which, again, if it's probabilistic, presents a problem. We're looking at sort of one possible behavior, so we have to somehow pick one time that's representative of our time distribution. And then we have to determine, sort of again, how the list changes as sort of events occur, and manage then the clocks as these events occur as well. So managing of clocks is just denoting the time. As the passage of time. Okay. So, still, what the simulation is going to generate is an event trace, so just a sequence of these time-stamped events. Okay. And so, the only thing essentially we can use to analyze the system is this sequence of events. And if that's not sufficient, well, you have to somehow add additional logic to sort of add more events that tell you more information. Okay. So we have our future event list. And That's the ultimate representation of state in the system. What we need to do is to be able to interpret that, so to understand what that means in terms of what happens next. The first thing, obviously, is to find the next event. So again, with the one with the smallest timestamp. We then advance our time in the system, so our master clock has to advance to the time of that next event. And then we have to decide what the appropriate action of that event is. And so again, typically we're going to have our sort of internal state model for the system, and that will have to be updated. And then we'll have to determine, are there any more potential future events? Okay. And so if there aren't, well, you just go back. If there are potential future events, then you have to create them. And by creating, we mean we have to sort of, well, have an event and a timestamp. And that has to be added to the future event list. So you just keep on going, sort of examining this future event list, determining how the list changes, and just keep doing that. Okay. So, again, we're not going to say anything sort of, again, about specific logics of how the decision of how we add and remove events is made. But what we are going to look at is sort of the mechanics of maintaining a list, okay, and the nature of the list that we're going to maintain is going to mean we're going to have to be a little careful about how we maintain it. So, if we think about what operations are required on the list, well, when we're sort of advancing, we are removing an event from the top of the list, so the front of the list. If we assume that this list is ordered according to our timestamps, then the first thing we need to do is figure out, well, who has the smallest timestamp? That's, if we order the list, that's the one at top, and just take them off. Again, with our system logic, it may be that because an event occurred, some other event no longer is going to occur. That has to be then removed from the list. What does that mean? Well, we have to search the list for the event and figure out how to sort of take it out. And if we're going to keep the list in some order, timestamp order, then we are going to have to add elements to the list at sort of random positions, or not just to the head of the list, but sort of somewhere in the middle of the list. Okay. Now, all of these make it a little bit tricky to maintain these sorts of lists. And we need to be aware that this event list can be of arbitrary length. Okay. So, and the occurrence of any event might spawn the future, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 future events. You never know. And in that case, the list is going to grow to some sort of greater length. Okay. So the most common way in which these lists are implemented is using what's called a linked list. Okay. And the benefit of linked lists is that they can be of arbitrary size. And you don't have to sort of pre-allocate the space for them. Now, you might think, well, why not just keep it in some sort of vector? And again, we see that there's a couple of problems. One problem with vectors is if you don't know the size to begin with, well, the vector is allocated as fixed size, you're in trouble. The other problem is trying to insert things into vectors. It ends up quite complicated if you're depending on sort of the physical position to denote ordering. If you have to insert something in, you've got to move all of the entries down, essentially. And so that's not efficient. A linked list is a way of getting rid of those problems. How many of you would have dealt with linked lists before? Just show of hands, or? I'm not going to ask you any questions. So a few of you, they know what I'm talking about with a linked list. Probably more, you're just shy. But depending on what languages you've used, they can be more or less difficult or confusing. If you've ever written one in C, you have to get into pointers and implementation with pointers, and that can be a bit of a pain. It usually takes people a while to figure out how that's done. It's straightforward enough in the end, but people don't like pointers. Java, you just call a nice class library and you're away. But to start with, I think we'll just talk a bit about what a linked list is, and then I'll just again point you in the right direction for implementing Java linked lists. Okay. And again, the idea of a linked list is you don't have to, you want an ordered list, but you don't have to sort of rely on sort of physical positioning for your ordering. So again, if we look at this example here, maybe physical, we are using physical positioning, so this is one slot in memory. Albert is in one slot in memory. Fred is in the next slot. Tim is in the next slot. We want to generate a list in alphabetical order. Well, then, if we want to insert Jane, we're going to have to move Tim and then slot Jane into Tim's previous slot. Now, that's fine if you're just moving Tim, but if you think about having maybe a million entries and you're trying to insert something in the middle, you're having to move half a million things down to do it. Then, of course, there's also the issue of sort of did you leave enough space? Okay, so we want to get away from that. So suppose we have cards or we've just put all our names somewhere, we don't know where. And we want to then link them in some way. Okay. So we're not allowed to use physical location anymore. Physical location is irrelevant. But we want to indicate now that they're related in some way. Okay. So, suppose you have, you want your alphabetical order. Then you can think of adding some information which essentially points to the next element in the list. Okay. So, you point to the start of the list, and then you continue on pointing to the elements in the list as they go. Okay. And so the elements of the list are sort of these two components, We have the actual data that we want to store, and then we have this information on the sequencing of the data. Okay. And again, if this were a course in C, we would now have to start talking about pointers and what exactly is that information that links one element to the next. I'm not going to get into that. We're just going to assume that we can link one element to the next so that we have this nice list. What's nice about it? Well, if we have another component, we don't need to worry about where to put it. We just put it somewhere. Typically, you can allocate the space on the fly, and then once you have the space, you just change how you're pointing to it. Okay. That's not completely trivial. So the allocation of space is easy. What's difficult, again, is you have to mess around with your pointing structure. Okay, so in order to add an element, you're going to have to change a number of these arrows, a number of the pointers. So for the old node, we now need the old node to point to the new node. We need the new node to point to where the old node was pointing, and we've got to get rid of that arrow as well. Okay. So we have to mess around with pointing. There is also an issue of ordering. How do we sort of find things in the list? Well, we have to go now. We have to follow these arrows, essentially. The only information we have about how to find an element in the list is from the previous element. Okay. So if we wanted to find Tim, we would have to go from Albert to Fred to Jane to Tim to find him. So there is an issue with searching through the list. The longer your list is, sort of, potentially longer it can take. Okay. Deleting old nodes, well, again, it's a matter of just changing these arrows so that you're pointing to the correct things. Okay, so, again, the big benefit of this for us is, well, that, again, we don't, that we aren't having to, well, essentially it gives us a mechanism for building up lists without having to, again, physically move locations if you want the ordering. So it's, again, a good way to develop ordered lists. Okay. Again, if you were dealing with a language like C, then each of these elements essentially is a data structure, and you have your data and a pointer. Okay. And so, and if you were dealing with C, I mean, I'm sure this, you can find a library somewhere, but you would have to write all of that. You'd have to write functions for removing things from the head of the list and inserting things, removing and inserting things into the middle of the list. Okay. And also for searching the list. Now, we're going to encourage you anyway to use Java when you are doing your implementation of a simulator. If you absolutely don't know Java, you can go and do it in C or C++ or something, but you'll have to write it in some higher level programming language. But the nice thing about Java is, well, Java doesn't want you touching pointers, so they provide you in java.util, you have a linked list class, which allows all of these informations like search and insert. And I've referenced one reference that discusses a bit about how that works. Otherwise, just look at the Java API as well, should tell you how that would work. Okay. So, the final note, again, what we're aiming for is the list we're trying to get is a list of time-stamped events, which are ordered according to their timestamping. And so, again, linked lists gives you a good way of building up sort of a list of arbitrary length that is ordered. Okay, so that we've got that covered in our linked lists. Just as a note, as we said, searching linked lists or inserting into random spots in linked lists can be a time-consuming activity because the only way to traverse a linked list is to start at the beginning and keep going from element to element to element till you find the one you want. So, and this is going to be good enough for our purposes. We're not going to get so many events that this is going to too adversely impact on performance. Potentially, though, it could. Other structures exist which help with the ordering function. Heaps are sort of an efficient structure for ordering a number of elements. So potentially you could perform the list operations that you needed to perform quicker using some other data structure. But again, for the types of things we're doing, linked lists are going to be perfectly fine. Okay. So, on to something more mathematical. So we need to be able to timestamp our events, and this is fine if they're deterministic. If they're random, we need to sort of pick numbers randomly. And what does that mean? Okay. And so, what we want to do is use some form of a random number generator. And so, you can't say that any one number in isolation is random. It's just a number. A sequence of numbers, you can start arguing about whether a sequence of numbers is random or not. And so what we want to do is to generate sequences of numbers that display properties that you would expect of a certain distribution. Okay, and so usually the distribution we start with is uniform. Why? Well, because it's easy. And what we want is that the numbers seem in some way random. if you just observe the sequence, you're not going to be able to predict what the next number in the sequence is, and that they roughly have the distribution you want. So that, you know, if it's uniform, well, you don't want all the numbers being close to zero or all the numbers being close to one. You want them sort of spread out, again, uniformly throughout the whole range possible. Okay. Once we have our basic pseudo-random numbers, so once we've generated a sequence that looks uniform, then we're going to have a look at what other tricks we can use to generate numbers with sort of other distributions besides uniform. And again, typically Java and other programming languages will provide you with some utility to generate random numbers without having to actually go doing it. But it's still sort of interesting to see how it's done. And as Peros points out, a lot of times it's interesting to perform tests on the random number generators that you're given to see whether they actually genuinely produce random numbers with the desired properties. Okay, so again, starting with terminology, a pseudo-random number sequence is one that adheres to a uniform random distribution. So if we generate the sequence, we say it has sort of properties that make it close enough to the random distribution. We're not going to say what close enough means at the moment, or in the next lecture we'll return to that sort of later, sort of as a sort of topic of interest, but just for now let's just say in some way it's close enough. Okay. Now, just for sort of I don't want to say uniformity, but just for the purposes of sort of boiling it down to a single distribution, we usually look at uniform between 0 and 1, and these sequences we'll refer to as random numbers. Okay. Once we've generated random numbers, we can again try and massage them to sequences following following some other distribution. And if we have other distributions, we refer to them as random variates. So a random variate is just a sequence of numbers that's adhering to some probabilistic distribution. Okay. Now, the numbers are called pseudo-random because they are not completely unpredictable. Typically, they're generated using some initial condition called a seed. And so you have a seed, you have an algorithm. If you use the same seed, you get the same sequence of numbers. Okay. And so this is actually potentially beneficial. If you're running simulations, sometimes you want to sort of reproduce the same behavior again and again, just to see sort of if things are correct or not. If you wish to produce different behavior, well, you have to start with different seeds. Okay. But because of this basis using a seed, they're not random, or they're not genuinely random. Typically, genuinely random event or sequences would be based on sort of some natural phenomenon, like sort of particle emission and decay is the times of the emissions are considered to be truly random. So if you observe that, you've got a truly random sequence. But that might be hard to observe, and it might not matter that it typically doesn't matter that our system isn't completely random, as long as it seems to be random, as long as it appears to be random. Okay, so there's a number of algorithms for producing these pseudo-random numbers, number sequences, and Harry Paris describes a number of them. We're just going to mention the congruential generators. They are some of the easier ways, and they can give you reasonably decent results. And again, the evaluation of a generator is how closely their sequences mimic truly random behavior. And again, Harry Paris is going to list a bunch of tests you can do to check this. We're not going to go into any detail on any of these tests now, although we will return to the chi-square test later on. Okay. So the distribution we're looking for is uniform over 0, 1. And so the PDF with probability density function is just 1 over 0, 1 and 0 elsewhere. And you can work out that the expectation is a half, so on average, you know, you're going to be in the middle. And the variance is 1/12. So, you know, at the very least, if you examined a sequence, you would expect your average to be near a half and your variance to be near a 12. So that would be sort of the very least you would expect out of your sequence. Okay. IID uniform 0, 1 variables have a number of other properties. If you divide the intervals from 0 to 1 into a number of subintervals, then you would essentially expect an equal amount of, if you have a large number of variables, you'd expect an equal amount to be falling in each of the subintervals. So again, this is something you know, that would be a very basic test you would use to determine if your random number generator was actually working. Okay. And finally, you should, sequences should be uncorrelated. You shouldn't be able to predict the numbers by observing previous values. Okay. So, one of the simplest ways to generate random numbers is the congruential method, and in this method we have three constants A, C, and M, and the numbers are generated iteratively with xi plus 1 equal to axi plus c mod m. Okay. And we can replace this linear function with some sort of more general function as well. Okay. So, what properties do we observe? Well, right off, we know that our numbers have to be between 0 and m minus 1, since we have this mod function. To get them down into the interval 0, 1, you can divide by m. Okay. And not every value of a, c, and m will give you an acceptably random result. Okay. And sort of there's complicated mathematics behind when this will work or not. But if you're just going to build a random number generator, there are certain values that are known to work that you don't necessarily, that you don't have to test yourself. Okay. And we have an example here that we won't go into exactly where that comes with at the moment. Okay, so just if you want to work out a simple example, we start with x is 0, a and c are 7, m is 10, and so we end up getting our first x1 that is 7 mod 10 is 7, x2 is 49 plus 7 is 56, mod 10 is 6, and we get 42 plus 7 is 49, mod m is 9, and 63 plus 7 is 70, mod 10 is back to 0, and so we can see we're going to cycle through. Okay. Now, that's just a simple example. It just illustrates a few of the comments we've made. What we see is that it's sort of disappointingly not random. You only, every four numbers it repeats. So this is not going to sort of, again, satisfy any nice statistical probability requirements. Okay. There are a number of rules. No matter what the maximum period, there is a sort of maximum periodicity of the generator, which is m. So you'll get at most m numbers out before it repeats. Again, if you're talking about, where are we, 2 to the 32, that's a fair amount of numbers. So the repetition might not be that frequent, but it will repeat. Yes, gone too far. Okay. And again, based on sort of a lot of mathematical theory, there are conditions which will ensure that the period is actually m. And the conditions are m and c have no common divisors. A mod r is 1 whenever r is a prime factor of m. And a mod 4 is 1 if m is a multiple of 4. So yet another factor of m. Okay. And again, we could go back and see, check our initial choices of A, C, and M, and we'll see that second condition doesn't hold. If you have A mod, well, what are the factors of M? 2 and 5 are prime factors of M. A mod 2 is 2, so it's not 1. A mod 5 is 5, not 1. Okay. So, again, as a practical matter, if you're going to write a generator using this, well, you just go and look up what everybody else has figured out are good values to use. Okay. So it's a bit rough and ready. It's quite simple. And it may or may not exhibit good properties for a generator. It depends on sort of, again, how closely you require the replication of randomness. Harry Perros, again, discusses a number of other techniques, and what you see is that they get successively more complex, and at times they don't necessarily even give you a better value. Okay. More likely, what you're going to do, again, is use some random number generator, which has already been tested. Again, Java provides random number generation for services for you. But again, sort of depending on how critical it is, you might want to test the generator yourself. Okay. So, again, Java Util has a random class which allows you to create random numbers, and it takes as its seed either the current time, which, again, from a user perspective makes it quite random, or you can pick your own seed to start with. Okay. And so, you can generate various distributions, or variates with various distributions, through this utility. Now, in terms of testing, again, I'm just going to mention these. There's a number of ways of sort of arguing about the goodness of your number sequence. And so if you write your own generator, you certainly want to do that. And even if you use somebody else's, you can't necessarily be sure that these tests have been done. Okay. And so there's a number of tests that you can perform. Okay, and so again, these are gone through in Harry Perros. And so you can test sort of the randomness of bits within a sequence. So you should have roughly the same number of zeros as ones. If you have sequences, you can check sort of again the correlation between various sequences. So if you look at part of the sequence, it shouldn't be correlated to any other part of the sequence. Okay. And if you have uniform 0, 1, then again, typically you can just get something like the chi-square test. Again, compares your numbers to what you would expect from such a distribution, and we'll return to that specific. We'll return to the chi-square test later in terms of sort of again comparing observed data to what you would expect out of the distribution. Okay, so assuming we do have our random numbers, so we've generated the sequence between 0 and 1. The final topic that we want to look at today is how we change that to looking at sort of a sequence which adheres to some other probability distribution. And we'll see that the easiest way is to use what's called the inverse transform technique. And in this case, we have a sequence R which is uniformly distributed, or adheres to this uniform distribution, and we would like to generate variates which adhere to some other distribution, and we assume that we have the cumulative distribution function f of x, then if we set r equal to f of x, we can take the inverse of that CDF to find x. So x is f inverse of r. And what we can reason is that if r now is uniformly distributed, then x is distributed according to this other distribution function. Okay. So, again, if we start out with our random variable x, we have some cumulative distribution function f, so that's just the probability that x is less than some fixed value here, and what we have now is we've set x equal to f inverse of r, but if we go back up then, that means that r is f of x, okay? So, since r then is uniformly distributed, if this is our x, then the probability of being in this region is going to be f of x, okay? So, just to look at a few examples, if you have distributions that you can write down easily, for example, if you have the exponential distribution, then you know that the CDF is 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. And so, to generate our random variates, again, we set r equal to f of x, which is 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. And then we try and get the inverse of that. And so we move the r over, we move the e to the minus lambda x over. We take the natural log of that. We divide by lambda. And sort of, again, just as a last little trick, we replace 1 minus r with r. Why is that legal? Because if you think about it, if you're distributed uniformly between 0 and 1, 1 minus r and r have exactly the same distribution. They're uniform between 0 and 1. That's just something to think about. Okay. So, if we wanted to generate a sequence of x's, well, we just take our sequence of r's and apply this function to them. And the new function, again, will have the exponential distribution. Okay. So, again, you can try and change it to something that's uniform over some different area. And so, again, what you'd need to do is come up with the CDF. And you do that by integrating from A to X, so to say. And then you just take the inverse function. So you just
take the inverse of F. And so
X is now a function
of R, which is our uniformly distributed random variable. Or uniform 0, 1, I should say, so our random numbers. Okay, and we already did that one, so don't need to do it again. Now, that works,
that technique works, as long as you can write down the cumulative distribution function easily, and as long as you can take the inverse of it. Now, in some cases that might not be possible, so there are various tricks and techniques for other functions that where that's not possible. And so there's just a bit of a laundry list of them depending on what you want. The airline distribution is just the sum of k exponentially distributed random variables, and the typical interpretation of this is a time to take a series of jobs. Each job has an exponential service time, and so how long does it, what's the total service time? And, well, it's hard to write that down, but we already know how to write down exponentially distributed variates, so we just add a bunch of them up. So we just add the k of them up. Okay. Now, one that's sort of perhaps of more interest is the normal distribution. And again, this is not something for which you can write down the CDF easily, okay, or at all. So what we do is we're going to try and build up some function of our simple variates that will approximate this, okay, and we normalize everything to a normal 0, 1 function, so you subtract off the average and divide by the variance. And what that allows you to do, again, is just sort of compare like with like, as we'll see. And what we're going to do is we're going to use the central limit theorem to produce a variate with the correct distribution. And specifically, what the central limit theorem says is that if we sum enough, a lot of IID random variables, then the distribution of the sum looks normal. Okay, and it has an average, which is just sort of however many you've summed up times whatever their average is, and again the variance is just a multiple of the variance of the single variable. Okay, so we have IID random variables, R1 through RK now, and so if we sum them up, then their distribution, so the distribution of K of these summed up should be normal with an average of K over 2, a variance of K over 12. And so, again, we can get that to look normal 0, 1, we subtract off the average divided by the variance. Now,
We have two elements, both of which are distributed normal 0, 1. So we set the two of them equal to each other. And again, this is the one where we want. So we solve for x. And we get x as a function of a sum of these uniform random variables. Okay. Another one is the Poisson process. And so this models the number of occurrences of an event over a period of time. And what we know about Poisson processes is that the lapse of time between two successive occurrences of the event is exponentially distributed with mean lambda. Okay. So we know how to generate variates that are exponentially distributed with a certain mean. And so what we want to essentially do is count up how many of those do we need to sum up before we get to, before we exceed 1. Because that number that we sum up is then this Poisson distributed variable. Okay. And so the final technique that I'll mention is modeling distributions that we get from observing actual data. Okay, so for the previous techniques, we said, well, there's some sort of mathematical distribution we know about, and we want to generate our random variates according to this. A lot of times, what you might have, or what you might have gathered, is you might have observed sort of the input to the system over a period of time. So you don't have any idea exactly what distribution this observes to, you've just adheres to, you've just taken a lot of observations, so you know that it does adhere to something. So what we can do is we can work out sort of a likely distribution. Okay, and the easiest place to start here is with a discrete probability distribution. So in that case, you have a number of points at which there's probabilities, and so you just need to figure out the probability for each one. Okay, and so so you have the probability that each sort of number occurs, and again, you can get a CDF from that. Okay, so this is the probability of one occurring, plus, and then P2 is if you add the probability that two occurred, plus the probability that three occurred, etc. Okay, so if you look at R now, well, the probability that R falls within this interval, so the probability that R is somewhere between P2 and P1 is obviously P2 minus P1 because it's uniformly distributed. And so that's, again, the probability that two occurred. Okay. So, in this case, you can assign, based on the value of R, you just assign it to the number relating to the interval. Okay.
So if R falls here, then you assign it a 1. If R falls here, you assign it a 3, and so on. Okay, and again, it's pretty easy to see the probability of falling into any of these intervals is what you want. Okay. Now, if you have a continuous distribution, well, you've only observed a discrete, and you've only observed a finite number of samples. So, to some extent, with your observations are, there's no way they can lead to anything besides a finite distribution. And so typically what you would do is you would produce some sort of histogram. So you would calculate the probability that, or observe the probability that your numbers fell into any sort of specific region. Okay. And that would give you your density function. And obviously from your density function, you can come up with your cumulative distribution function. Now, in this case, we don't want to map to discrete points. What we want to do is map to sort of points along the continuum. And so what we do to do that is we just, we have these sample points for the cumulative distribution function, and we just interpolate between them. So we say that there's a linear transition between one point and the next. And that piecewise defines what your CDF is, and you can then apply the inverse transform technique, sort of depending on where you are piecewise. Obviously, you can just write it down. Okay. And so, again, we're going to return to the idea of sort of comparing observed samples to actual distributions later. Okay, so that's it for today. So what you need to walk away with is, or think about, is exactly what do simulations model? Okay, and how do we model things using simulations? Okay, and then think of just having arrived at, or been given a small toolkit of how you're actually going to generate the components of a simulation. So you've been given some way of handling lists and now some way of time stamping the events for the lists. Okay. Now, next time we're going to consider what information can we get from simulations now. So we have one sample of random behavior. How can we use this one sample or a finite number of samples to generalize to what the system looks like or how the system's going to behave in general? So, have a good weekend. It's a long weekend, and yay! And I will see you guys next Friday.